It's hard to imagine a world without answering machines, without tape recorders, record CD players, and iPods, without recording and playback devices of any kind. Sound recording has dramatically changed our lives and our world, and that's why we have made it the subject of today's edition of Please Explain. I'm joined now by Evan Eisenberg, who is the author of The Recording Angel, a book which explores recorded music and its cultural meanings, and Michael Taft, head of the American Folklife Center and the Save Our Sounds, America's Recorded Sound Heritage Project at the Library of Congress. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Evan, let's begin with you. What are some of the early references we have to sound recording? When did the idea of recording sound first begin to occupy people's thinking?
Well, I think that probably the idea of recording sound, the idea of being able to hear what you just said or sang, probably goes back to when people first heard an echo. And it's probably no coincidence that in Greek mythology, Echo and Narcissus are associated, because this is sort of the oral equivalent of looking in the mirror, if you think about it. But there's a wonderful passage from a book by Cyrano de Bergerac, of all people.
The real Cyrano
the
de Bergerac,
real,
not
historical.
The guy invented by
that's right.
Edmond Rostand.
That's right. The historical Savinien Cyrano de Bergerac wrote a book, a science fiction novel, called Histoire comique des états et des empires de la lune, comical history of the states and empires of the moon. And he described the inhabitants of the moon and their peculiar speech, which was a kind of wordless music, and their books. And I just want to read this quote because I think it's so wonderful. At the opening of the box, I found something in metal almost similar to our clocks, filled with an infinite number of little springs and imperceptible mechanisms. It is a book indeed, but a miraculous book, without pages or letters. It is a book to learn from, for which eyes are useless, only ears are needed. When someone wishes to read, he winds up the mechanism with a large number of all sorts of keys. Then he turns the pointer towards the chapter he wishes to hear, and immediately, as if from a man's mouth or a musical instrument, this machine gives out all the distinct and different sounds which serve as the expression of speech between the noble moon dwellers.
And that's how audiobooks were invented.
That's right.
Michael Taft, can you tell us about some of the early sound recording attempts?
Well, I think actually some of them probably stem from what de Cyrano de Bergerac was writing about. I think our earliest sound recordings are music boxes from the 18th century.
Mm-hmm.
You think about them as a mechanical device that can replicate sound in a way which we don't think of too much as a sound recording, but in fact I would say maybe that's the first attempt, the music boxes and church clocks and things like that.
And then later, player pianos?
And player pianos, of course, they come a bit later. Actually, they have an interesting history. Player pianos started really as an idea in the year 1800 to use a template for automatic weaving machines in textile mills. And a plate with holes in it that would direct the thread in certain ways. And around 50 years later, 50 or 60 years later, that principle is applied to player pianos in order to make music. But, you know, I think probably the real grandfather of the modern recording era is the phonautograph. And that was an interesting invention around 1857 by a Frenchman named Leon Scott de Martinville. And his idea is really no different from the basic principles that we've used to record sound up until the digital age. And I think as I describe this machine, I think you'll begin to see how it's very similar to later inventions. Essentially what he did, he took a horn that looked like a megaphone and put a diaphragm on the small end with a needle attached to the diaphragm and rested the needle against a glass coated with lampblack. And as he moved the glass and shouted or spoke into the horn, the needle vibrated and left its markings on the lampblack. And essentially what it was doing, it was transferring sound to something visible as a sound wave.
And what was missing there, the playback part?
The playback. He had absolutely no way of playing back these recordings. And he modified the machine, made it better, so eventually the needle was resting on a rotating drum. And recording on something which is a little bit more stable than lampblack, but still there was no way of playing back these sounds. In fact, he had no intention of playing them back. I think his main reason for the machine was to show how sound could be reinterpreted as the sound wave.
I understand that, or I've heard anyway, that Abraham Lincoln made one of those phono autographs. Can that be located and then played back now?
I think that might be a rumor. it is known that that Scott did demonstrate his machine in Washington when Lincoln was in office. But I'm not sure that there's any evidence that we really have Lincoln's voice.
So it was really Edison who figured out the playback aspect of this?
Yes. Edison, I think, probably knew about Scott's invention. It was patented. He did figure out how you could find a medium that not only captured the sound as a wave, but stored it in a way that could be played back. And what that really meant was, instead of having a glass with lampblack on it or a drum, he invented the cylinder recording. And at first, it was made out of tin foil.
And we have a recording of one of Edison's assistants that we're going to play now that was recorded on the tin foil. Well, that wasn't exactly a hi-fi recording, but was it that bad initially, or is that just because it's so old?
Well, of course, age doesn't help, but I don't think it was too much better initially. In fact, that's the voice of Frank Lambert, who certainly got the idea from Edison and worked a bit with him. That recording, we believe, is from 1878 and is the oldest extant recording, as far as we know, that could be played back. And in fact, I don't know if your listeners could hear it, but he's saying 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock. He's saying the hours of the day.
Oh, I thought he was doing an early Bill Haley imitation.
First rock song. But I think his idea was a talking clock.
My guests are Michael Taft of the American Folklife Center and Evan Eisenberg, author of The Recording Angel. And this is Please Explain on the Leonard Lopate Show on WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. Evan, what did Edison hope his sound recording device would provide or be able to do for people?
Well, the last thing he had in mind was music, although that's not entirely accurate. That was actually the fourth thing he had in mind. He made a list, which he made public, of the things that he intended his device to do, that he thought his device could do. So it starts, letter writing and all kinds of dictation without the aid of a stenographer. 2, phonographic books, the Cyrano thing, which will speak to blind people without effort on their part. 3, the teaching of elocution. 4, reproduction of music. 5, the family record, a registry of sayings, reminiscences, etc., by members of the family in their own voices, and of the last words of dying persons, and so on. So the list goes on, but music is not high on the list.
Edison, although all of those things did wind up being applications, well, one of his early ideas was to make voice clocks, wasn't it?
Yes, that was one of he had a whole slew of ideas, including dictation machines. He tried very hard to make a go of, and answering machines. In fact, he actually originally wanted to record electrical impulses from the telephone rather than sound waves from the air, but he couldn't do it, so he settled for second best.
But it was music that really drove the technology
forward. It was, much to Edison's surprise. And initially, of course, the sound was pretty bad, and Edison's own taste in music was appalling, so there wasn't much repertoire that people could buy. But someone finally had the bright idea of coming up with coin-operated phonographs that they could put in arcades, and you'd put in a nickel and you'd hear a John Philip Sousa march or a vaudeville number, something like that. And people ate those up. And so eventually that led to a market for records. But it didn't really take off until Berliner's Disc and then, of course, the Victrola, which was the first really popular phonograph.
Well, let's listen to a sample of some music recorded fairly early on, 1894.
Thank you.
the Hallelujah Chorus played by the New York Battery Band. Again, I'm not sure whether the band was just bad or whether it's been distorted by history. But
I think the battery had run down.
Some people were not thrilled by the idea of recording music.
Yes, some people felt that it cheapened the experience of music. In fact, Debussy, who visited the Salon du Phonographe, which was an equivalent of these arcades, a little bit later in Paris, said, "You know, the magic of music will be lost when you can buy it for the cost of a glass of beer." And many people felt that, and in fact, I argued in my book. Not quite at that time. I think I argued slightly later than the early 1900s, but that the great architecture of time that music was embedded in the social ritual, in the order of the year, the liturgical calendar, the seasons, and so forth, that a Bach cantata was embedded in, or an Indian raga or tala. There was always a sort of social ritual of music, and of course that was shattered by the phonograph, because now you could listen to St. Matthew's Passion while you're taking a bath.
On the other hand, there is still something wonderful about going to a concert and hearing the music performed live, but I think nobody's arguing against records, and it did help when Victor sent Fred Ginsburg, the first great record producer around the world, to record music from other parts of the world and brought them to Americans' ears.
It's interesting. We sort of assume that globalization means homogenization, and that somehow Western culture conquers the world and just swamps everything else. But it hasn't really worked that way. Certainly not in music. And if you look at Geisberg, who was sent out by the gramophone and typewriter company starting around 1900, first thing he did was he recorded the barmaid in the inn where he was staying on Maiden Lane. But then he went all over the world. He went to all the great capitals of Europe, recorded all the great musicians of the day. He went to Bombay, Calcutta, Kazakhstan, Afghanistan. And the interesting thing was he was recording local music, often for local markets. But of course, eventually that music began to spread, and the globalization of music meant that we became familiar with Afghani music. But there were some musicians such as Caruso, of course, who quickly became household words all across the world. And Caruso was an interesting case because he found him in Milan in 1902. Caruso was an up and coming tenor, and asked for £100 as his fee for an afternoon of recording. And so Geisberg was a little startled, and he telegraphed back to London for permission, and they said, "Fee is exorbitant. We forbid you to record." But he overrode his orders, fortunately.
Now, Michael Taft, Edison did cylinders. Why did he come up with that approach, and how did we wind up with flat discs?
Well, I think I don't quite know why Edison picked the cylinder. I guess it seemed a natural way to go at the time, considering previous technology. The music box worked on a cylinder basis, and again, the photo autograph also worked that way. I'd just like to mention before I go on that this idea of internationalizing music through recording was fairly early also in terms of folklorists and anthropologists using the recording machine to record other cultures' music and words.
As an anthropologist, you felt you should make that point.
Yes. In fact, at our archive here, we have the earliest ethnographic recording by Jesse Walter Fuchs, who recorded the Passamaquoddy Indians in Maine back in 1890, which by any standards is a very early recording and a fairly clear one, too.
Uh-huh. And so people went around with regular recording equipment to the most remote places in the world?
Yes, and for someone like Fuchs, he had just pretty much heard about this machine that was available from Edison himself, and it did not take him long to figure how useful this would be, and also how portable the machine was. This was a spring-wound machine. It did not need electricity. So that was one of the values of the early cylinder machines. They were fairly portable.
And we have a wax cylinder recording from 1915 that is recorded by an Omaha Indian ritual of the maize.
Yeah.
What do you think that sound, recorded sound, tells us that nothing else can? Because before we could record things, we had a very different sense of history, didn't we?
Well, I think that we're used to communicating through sound. And we're most sophisticated at communicating through language and sound rather than through the written word. And I think the ability to capture that was a major, breakthrough in terms of documenting human culture. And I think it had a great and rather profound effect upon people early on. They realized immediately the effect of this. They were fascinated immediately. And I think in the same way as at just about the same era at the end of the 19th century when moving images, when film came along, it didn't matter what the film was about. It really didn't matter what the recording was. You know, we can joke about the terrible sound of the early bands or the hokey vaudeville routines or whatever that were recorded. But, you know, I think for the early audience, they didn't care so much what it was. They were fascinated by the sound. They would listen to anything the same way as they would watch any early film back in 1900, just because the whole medium itself was fascinating.
Well, over the 20th century, we saw the sound recording evolve quite quickly, but pretty much all the same idea, whether it was direct-to-disc, Evan, or whether it was discs as the thing that were used for pressing other discs, mm-hmm. or whether it was wire tape or the tape that the Germans developed that went into our tape recorders until fairly recently.
Right. I mean, it was very important that Berliner went to the disc rather than the cylinder because it was much easier. His notion was you could stamp a disc. You could make many copies of a disc. It's hard to make copies of a cylinder. And in fact, the early recordings on the Edison cylinder were in a way more intimate than a concert performance because the performer was really singing for one person or one family. You could only make one copy with the original recordings, and of course it was economically absurd, which is one reason it didn't take off very quickly. But I would say there were obviously lots of there was high fidelity, there was stereo, there was the long playing record, and so on and so forth. But I think tape was very important, and it was kind of strange. The Germans, the tape in its highly developed form was something that we basically captured. It was one of the spoils of war. But it was actually the first wire magnetic recording was made by a Danish engineer named Paulsen in 1898, and the technology was developed in Europe rather than in the States. That is, it evolved in Europe rather than in the States because AT&T and the FCC were very skittish about telephone answering machines and recording. They wouldn't let you put an answering machine on their lines because they thought it was an invasion of privacy. And of course, Nixon later proved them right. But anyway, the Europeans somehow were less skittish about it, and so they developed magnetic tape. But the reason that's important is that, what records did was they didn't just preserve a performance. From the very beginning, they created something new, which I call phonography, recorded music as an art in itself, as distinct from live music as cinema is different from theater. It's just a different art. But that fully came into its own with multi-track recording and the possibilities of splicing and multi-tracking.
And when we come back from a little break, we'll get to the digital age and take your calls at 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. I promise you there will not be an 18-minute gap between now and when we come back. My guests are Evan Eisenberg and Michael Taft, and we're talking about recording and the changes in recording techniques on today's Please Explain. We're back with Michael Taft, head of the American Folklife Center and the Save Our Sounds, America's Recorded Sound Heritage Project at the Library of Congress. Also, Evan Eisenberg, author of The Recording Angel, which is a book that explores recorded music and its cultural meanings, and that's a rather important aspect of this. Our number here is 212-433-9692. I'm sure some of the calls will deal with whether people think that one kind of recording technique is better than another. There are some people who still think 78s were the best ever. But what happened with digital? Michael, digital, the concept of digital technology has been around a long time. Why did it take so long for someone to apply it to sound recording?
Well, I think that the technology was around for a while, but finding a way of compacting the disc and a playback machine which was easy to use by the general public and not too large, that took a little bit longer. Also, I think just we were so used to very easy and convenient ways of recording and playing back sound. We think about the cassette tape recorder, a very easy sort of one-shot deal for listening or recording music. But, you know, I think that, you know, the great leap came, and there's no going back. We're now in the digital age.
Evan, you tell the story of cassette swapping and computer geeks and the Grateful Dead as part of this whole evolution.
Yes, that's not something from my book. That's something that I've just stolen from John Alderman's book about MP3 and Napster and Grokster and all that. But he has a theory that that file swapping culture actually originated in the sort of confluence of Stanford area computer geeks and deadheads, so that people who used to follow the Grateful Dead around and record their concerts and then swap the cassettes were also many of them computer engineers, and this notion that these files could be traded sort of peer to peer, established the model for what became file trading.
Now, Michael, can you give us an explanation of how digital recording works in the simplest of terms?
Well, in the simplest of terms, it's in some ways it's not too different from previous ways of recording. If you go back to the 78 recording, we're dealing, if you think of a CD, with, again, a disc with several layers of material on it. But whereas the 78 recording had grooves with etched sound waves in them that could be replayed by a needle, in a CD, what you have are a series of very small pits throughout the disc itself. And what happens is a laser runs over these pits and then the spaces in between the pits. And the arrangement of these pits is equivalent to ones and zeros, and this is the way any computer reads information, a string of ones and zeros. So what happens in a digital recording is that the sound wave has been translated, if you like, into a series of ones and zeros, which a laser can then read, and then the computer software can reinterpret back as sound. So that the real difference there is that instead of having a physical sound wave on wax or on paper or whatever, you've got ones and zeros which represent portions of that sound wave.
Well, why is it that when we first started hearing CDs, many audiophiles said that they really did not give us the full spectrum? I would have thought that with digital we could do everything that we could do with any other recording technique. Along came DVDs. People said that they would offer us greater fidelity. Now new technologies are being introduced. Are there still some kinks in digital technology that have to be worked out?
Well, I don't know if they're kinks so much as remember that the recording you hear, no matter what the medium is not the same as the original source that made it. There is an intervention of both a technology and machinery as well as somebody else's human ear, the engineer, who is, if you like, massaging that sound so that it can be played back to you. There's a lot of intermediaries between you and the original horn player or singer or banjo strummer. And I think that with the CDs, it may be a matter of a certain kind of over-engineering for that perfect sound at the expense of a lot of ambient sound that humanizes or perhaps makes the sound a bit softer as it would have been in the world of vinyl recordings.
You wanted to add to that, Evan?
Yeah, I just wanted to jump in. The you know, we sort of assume that the history of high fidelity has been linear, but in fact, linear progress. But that's no more true of high fidelity than it is of human history. And you know, in fact, fidelity is a very subjective notion. You know, in music as it is in marriage. And the when electric recordings came out. There are many people, Compton Mackenzie, editor of the Gramophone, said electrification equals vexation. People thought it was harsh, the same thing they said when digital first came out. But, you know, it has to do with very complicated things like sampling rates. You know, they're sampling something like 50,000 times a second. They're sampling the shape of this sound wave. But I think the important thing to realize is that this is the second great conceptual leap. The first one was with the phonautograph and then with Edison's machine. People realized that they had initially assumed that all sounds are different, and therefore to reproduce them, you use different kinds of machines. You know, there was Jacques Vaucanson's talking duck. There was Joseph Faber's talking head that reproduced human speech by reproducing the human vocal tract. There were player pianos. There were music boxes and so on. And then finally people realized, well, sound is waves. Of course, they'd known this for a very long time, but it finally occurred to them that, no, it's an abstract process to reproduce sound. Digital is an equally great conceptual leap. They're saying music, sound is information. And the major thing to realize here is that when records came along, music became a thing. It had been the most ephemeral and ethereal of the arts and the darling of the Romantics for that very reason. And then it became a thing that you could collect and hoard and amass. With digital, it seems it's no longer a thing.
And now we have Glenn Gould for all time. Let's take some calls. Jeffrey from the East Village. Hi, you're on the Leonard Lopate Show. Please explain.
Hi, Leonard.
Yes, Jeffrey.
Nice to talk to you. It's been ages. The reason I called is I was involved in editing the recording of the only castrato who was ever recorded. And it was in 1902 that it was recorded. And the technique was the cylinder, and as your guests were talking about the fact that electricity was not needed. So because of that, the engineers, as it were able to record the singer in 1902. And the reason for it was they were intending to record Pius X, who was very ill. And so everyone said, well, we have Musico in our choir, our director. And because of that, they were able to record the last castrato named Alessandro Moreschi. And I was involved in putting it on CD and arranging the keys by an adjustable turntable to adjust keys so that it doesn't sound funny, and the result is what we have today, an historical recording of the only castrato who was recorded.
Evan?
It occurs to me that I had the rare privilege of being present at the creation of a castrato. And this was a more humane form. This was a virtual castrato. It was created by Johan Sundberg, and you may know about this. He's a Swedish scientist who specializes in the analysis of the voice and in using computer programs to alter voices. And in this case, he was able to sort of put a tenor buzz on the voice of a boy soprano and sort of create, in a very humane way, a castrato. This is an example of the sorts of things you can do with digital technology.
Thank you for calling us, Jeffrey. We go now to Peter from Long Island City. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Leonard. How are you doing?
I'm well. What's your question?
Well, I like your show, first of all. I don't just say that. And I wanted to ask about the difference between after tape recording was introduced, I guess, by the Germans, as you said. They had a thing called a master tape, and that was usually used as the basis for all reproductions of the music. But in the days of the 78, I think they had a thing called a metal stamper. And I always wondered how that worked exactly, how they made copies, and also what was due to the fact that the original metal stamper was not the pristine copy, which, say, is used now in the reproduction of 78s on CDs.
Michael Taft? Are you still there, Michael?
No, this is Peter.
I know, but oh. we... Oh. Have we lost Michael?
Oh, you lost one of your guests.
Oh, well. Do you know the answer?
That's most unfortunate, because I was hoping Michael could answer that. I'm really more of a philosopher, and I'm afraid
so
some of the technical details are lost on me.
But
I'm
I understand that initially recordings were done direct to disc, and then they started using those discs as molds and then made those stampers. So it was kind of like a plaster of Paris copy that then got made into another sculpture.
That's right.
And then right before we started getting into CDs, we started seeing direct-to-disc again on a whole other level for the highest fidelity of high fidelity.
What does that direct-to-disc mean exactly?
I think in that context, direct-to-disc means that they dispensed with the master tape. And that meant that there was less manipulation. They weren't using splices. They weren't using multitrack. They were using a single microphone. I think Nimbus was one of the companies that was doing this quite often.
We got Michael Taft back. I'm not sure you know the question, Michael.
Yes, I did hear it.
Uh-huh.
Oh, good.
So you want to give us the technical answer?
Well, I think Evan pretty much covered. I think it's essentially in the, let's say, the 1930s, when a commercial company made a disc, they would record the singer on an acetate or lacquer disc to begin with, and that disc would be put into a mold so that a metal stamper could be made. And it was the stamper that would stamp out the actual product that was sold.
Wasn't one of the big changes early when, in fact, I think it happens in the 20s, you almost hear it in the history of jazz, when they went from acoustic to electronic recording?
Yeah, around 1925, that's when that change occurred. And of course, before that, if you had a full orchestra in a studio, you had to have horns all over the place to try to pick up the different sounds.
One of the important things about electrical recording was that rather than having to sort of project the way legitimate, you know, quote, legitimate singers had always done, the way you would project into a concert hall, you have to project into a recording horn in order to make a recording. But with the electrical recording, you could sing into the microphone, and people like Bing Crosby and Billie Holiday turned that into an entirely new style of singing.
We have very little time, but I wanted to sneak Flynn in here. Flynn, can you ask the question quickly? I guess not. Okay, so David from New York. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you today?
Well, could you make it very quick?
Yeah, sure. Actually, I just had a comment about the subject of how come it's taken so long for the digital to come in, and I think a lot of it has to do with definitely the speed and expense of that process. I actually am a graduate of the Institute of Audio Research and currently work there. And I think, you know, on the whole, digital still is, it's still in kind of like an infancy stage, so to speak. I think for the mass public, digital means to them MP3s, which to the high fidelity MP3s still, are compressed, and you can store a lot of these in storage, but still the sound quality to the audio file is still under par.
And I appreciate your comment, and I thank you so much for making your call, and my great thanks to my two guests today on Please Explain. We've been talking with Evan Eisenberg, who has written The Recording Angel, a book which explores recorded music and its cultural meanings, and Michael Taft, who's the head of the American Folklife Center and the Save Our Sounds, America's Recorded Sound Heritage Project at the Library of Congress. Thank you both so much.